It doesn't really matter what phase of life you're in. We've all had to spend some time waiting. I remember one of the first times I learned that lesson. I was a little boy. It was my birthday. It was June. I got a brand new kite. I was so excited. I was telling my grandparents about how I wanted to go out and fly the kite. My granddad said, "Look, son, there's no wind." I said, "Well, I'll make some wind." And I ran out in the front yard, and I remember very vividly, my birthday's in June. It was hot, Middle Tennessee, running back and forth in the yard, trying to make that kite fly, and it'd get about 5, maybe 10 feet off the ground, and I don't know how long it was. It feels like a couple of days as a little boy, but I, you know, sort of sheepishly went back to the carport, sat beside my granddad. He said, "Well, son, I guess you've learned to wait on the wind." That's a valuable lesson, and it doesn't really matter how old we are. We all have to spend some time waiting from time to time, and I'm not very good at that. I know that some of us have spent time waiting, perhaps for results from the doctor. We've spent time waiting as others are in surgery. We've spent time waiting, could be something positive, that we just can't wait to hear what the outcome of that might be. We all have to wait from time to time. One of my favorite books in the Bible is Psalms, because really, it doesn't matter where we are, how we feel, where we might be in life. Psalms seems to speak in a very powerful way, a God-inspired way, to our life situations. I was recently reading Psalm 62, where we're going to spend some time together tonight. It's a brief psalm, only about 12 verses. And one of the things that stood out to me in this psalm, in both verse 1 and in verse 5, we are encouraged to wait. The psalmist, David, on this occasion says, "Wait, wait, my soul, wait on God." And what we see there is a very personal and powerful lament, a way of David pouring out his heart. And it's difficult sometimes to know exactly what's going on in the life of the one who is pouring out his heart before God. About a third of those 150 psalms that we have in the book of Psalms are anonymous, and so sometimes it's very difficult to connect that psalm to a real life situation. But if you look at the superscription there above Psalm 62, a couple of things are said. We read, first of all, that this was a psalm of David. We know a lot about David's life, although we don't know exactly what was going on when this psalm was written. But we also see there that this psalm was devoted or dedicated to Jeduthun. That's not a very common name, but a couple of times in 1 Chronicles, we learn that Jeduthun was an individual who was among the 288 Levites that were musically gifted for service in the temple. And that really after the passing of Jeduthun, his descendants continue to be referred to in that way. They're known as those who stand at the gate and play instruments. And so for whatever reason, perhaps something that was associated with that group of workers in the temple, perhaps there was an event that caused them to want to sing and play about the kinds of distress that David's describing in this psalm of deep personal lamentation. All we know is that over 12 verses, we have a very powerful picture of what it is that David was pouring his heart out with regard to as he felt alone, as he felt distressed. This psalm is sometimes referred to as the only psalm. And the reason it's called that is the word only, which is really a particle in Hebrew, happens 6 times. It occurs 6 times in 12 verses. And 4 of the times it occurs, it is intentionally placed at the beginning of the verse. We see that word occur at the beginning of verse 1, verse 2, verse 5, verse 6, and then in verse 4 and in verse 9, even though that particle isn't at the beginning of the sentence, it's there. And so when you read this in the original language, it's as if David, as he's describing this very distressed time in his life where he's waiting on God's justice, he's surrounded by distress on every side, that he is just simply calling out to God saying, "God, on you alone, in you only have I put my trust." And so it's the only psalm. But as we look through these verses, I want us to note that even though there may be some questions about David's situation, we know our situations, and we know that sometimes waiting isn't a good thing. And at other times, simply put, because we're not in control of the universe, we're not in control of our own outcomes, we're not in control necessarily of what's even going to happen later tonight or tomorrow. The Lord knows, we don't know. We walk by faith, and that requires that we spend some time waiting. Perhaps tonight some of you are waiting. waiting to find out if a relationship will be reconciled, waiting to find out what the prognosis might be given a recent medical test, waiting to know whether that job that you've applied for is going to work out as you've prayed it would work out. There are all kinds of things that we wait for, and it doesn't have to be something that necessarily makes the news. These kinds of things can distress us. I know that sometimes we say a lot of things in a sermon, so I just want to make the main point tonight clear as we begin. I think David, in a God-inspired way, is reminding us that sometimes faith stands still. Sometimes faith is demonstrated in waiting. I have a bad habit, when I think about faith, of thinking about activity, maybe outburst of activity. Maybe it's a service project or a worship service or some kind of fellowship activity or a short-term campaign of some sort. We oftentimes associate faith with some kind of short outburst of activity. But I think we see in Psalm 62 that faith can also be expressed in simply waiting, in standing still, not because we're inactive, not because we don't desire as disciples to be diligent in the work of the Lord, but because sometimes that's all we can do. And as we wait and as we wonder, simply holding on to the faith can be an amazingly powerful demonstration of what faithfulness looks like in response to the faithfulness of our great God. Notice as this psalm begins, in Psalm 62, the first two verses, and this sentiment is repeated again in verses 5 and 6, that David, as he pours his heart out before God, and I love the parallelism. I love the way that verses 1 and 2 really get repeated in verses 5 and 6. When you compare them side by side, there's very little difference in these two parts of Psalm 62. It's as if David wants to remind the reader, which he certainly has in mind. When we get to about verse 7, he pivots and he begins to address people who need to have the same kind of faith in God that King David is demonstrating in the midst of his distress. And so David says, "My soul waits in silence for God. He is my salvation." In verse 5, he words that a bit differently. "My hope is in him." So personal. When you look at all the times that he uses that "my" language, this is assuring. This is real confidence, boldness in the life of David. He describes God in so many ways in these 12 verses as my rock, as my salvation, as my stronghold, as my refuge. We'll see later on in this text. He says, "I will not be shaken." Notice the first time he says this, he says in verse 1, "I will not," or verse 2, "I will not be greatly shaken." And then when this is repeated again in verse 6, we lose the "greatly." And I've often wondered as I've read through this brief psalm, perhaps we're seeing David's faith grow. We're seeing his desire to honor God come out even more clearly as he begins to consider his enemies as they are compared to the great and faithful God above. David here pours his heart out. He makes it clear that God is his refuge, his strength, his rock, his salvation. And notice that even though this is a petition of sorts, this is a praise being given to God in the midst of his lamentation. One of the things I love about reading Psalms of Lamentation is that even when these petitioners are crying out with heavy hearts, they still acknowledge the faithfulness of God. They still put their hope and their trust in him. And we don't know exactly what it is that David's dealing with, but I admire the fact, I'm impressed by the reality that when you read these 12 verses, David never asked for anything specifically. And I think the reason David never asked for anything specifically is he's talking about these evildoers and these enemies that are surrounding him and the trouble that he's facing is because he knows, he has habitual trust, he knows that God is his rock, his stronghold, his refuge, his salvation. He knows, as we might say, that God's got this. God's bigger than my adversaries. He's bigger than my worries. "Be still, my soul. Wait in silence." There's a time to speak, and there's a time to be silent. But when we know that there's really nothing we can do to change the outcome of a situation, sometimes it's really difficult to wait, especially when we're fixers. We want to go around and solve problems. We can't solve every problem. We don't know the answer to every question. Sometimes faith simply trusts and waits and says, Lord, I don't know where this is going, but I know who you are, and I know that you're bigger than the distress that I find myself in at this time. David says, God, I trust you. And then notice as we continue how strong the language of verses 3 and 4 is. In between the descriptions of David's call upon God to wait in silence as he wonders how God will respond, never asking for anything specifically, notice what he says in verses 3 and 4. As he describes his enemy, the evildoer, he asks rhetorically, how long will you assail a man that you may murder him, all of you, like a leaning wall, like a tottering fence? They have counseled only to thrust him down from his high position. They delight in falsehood. They bless with their mouth, but inwardly they curse. I don't know what was happening in David's life. I've wondered, could this be 2 Samuel 12 when David's sin with Bathsheba was confronted by Nathan the prophet? Could it be 2 Samuel chapter 13 when Amnon and Tamar are involved in those awful circumstances that leads in 2 Samuel 18 to Absalom killing his half-brother, fleeing for about 5 years, returning and trying to make a claim to David's throne that eventually gets him killed? Could it have been near the end of David's life when Adonijah rebels and David appoints Solomon, the son of Bathsheba, to be the next king? And as a result of that war, Adonijah is also put to death. There are so many circumstances in King David's life that could have led to him saying, with God's aid, something like, they are counseling to throw me down from my high position. They are seeking to murder me, to eliminate me. They are assailing me. They want me to be fired. They want me to be destroyed. They want me to fail. I don't know if we've ever felt that way, but regardless of what the particular circumstances might be, David is distressed. And as he describes these evildoers, it's amazing to think about this language. The way that he just simply says, they want to make me fail. Whether he's saying they want to literally murder him or not, I don't know. But we do know from ancient Near Eastern history, from the Greco-Roman context, that one way to eliminate leaders was to assassinate those leaders. That happened with great frequency, even in the Old Testament. It's hard to get life insurance when you're the king of Israel. Maybe that's what David's concerned about. He says, they're assailing me. They want to murder me. They delight in things that are false. And it's almost like the proverbial statement made in James chapter 3 and verse 10 with regard to how sweet water and bitter water ought not come from the same source. That's exactly what these evildoers were up to. They were talking out both sides of their mouth. They were offering flattery, but on the inside, they wanted to see David destroyed. They wanted to see him fail. It's interesting in this context when David talks about a leaning wall or a tottering fence. Depending on your translation there in verse 3, some translations like the ESV make it sound like we're talking about David, that David feels like he is a leaning wall, that he is a tottering fence. But the language here would allow for this to actually be a description of the evildoers, where David is in effect saying, I know you're going to fail. Contrast that idea. You're a leaning wall. What's God? He's a rock. He's a stronghold. He's a fortress. He's my salvation. And so whether it's David that's the tottering fence or the enemies that are the leaning wall, God is secure. And so in contrast to the insecurity of David's accusers, David's opponents, those who want to throw him from this position of high power, we see assurance and confidence that in contrast to the leaning wall, there is the great God that David is depending upon. And that's where he goes in the rest of this psalm. Notice how, beginning right after that second, the repetition there in verses 5 and 6 of verses 1 and 2, where again, David cries out and says, God, I trust you. I'm going to wait in silence for you. We see that interjection. Verse 7, O God, my salvation and my glory rest, the rock of my strength, my refuge is in God. Trust in him at all times, O people. Notice how he turns. He's not just thinking about himself. He is a leader. He is a shepherd. He is a member of the descendants of Abraham. He wants all of these people to know that God isn't just there for the king. He's not just there for David. He's there for all of his people. Verse 8, trust in him at all times, O people. Pour out your heart before him. God is a refuge for us. Notice the rest of the psalm. Men of low degree are only vanity, and men of rank are a lie. In the balances they go up, they are together lighter than breath. Do not trust in oppression, and do not vainly hope in robbery. If riches increase, do not let your heart set upon them. Once God has spoken, twice I have heard this. That power belongs to God, and loving kindness is yours, O Lord, for you recompense a man according to his work. What's David saying? There's a lot of injustice. There are a lot of things that can distract us from the security of the stronghold, the rock, the fortress, the refuge of God. Things that we might look at that we think might bring security. The language of scales is present in verse 9. Whether we're people of high esteem, high rank, people that the world looks at and says, huh, you're somebody, or people of low rank, the language of verse 9 is that when you put God on one side of that scale, it doesn't matter how high or low we might feel in the eyes of the world, God is sovereign. His power is evident. The scales shift when his power is considered, because as verse 8 says, he is a refuge for us. Some may trust in their status. Some may trust in greed, in crime. That's ultimately what verse 10 is all about. Trusting in oppression, vainly hoping in robbery. Maybe I will gain favor. That's a temptation we see a lot in Proverbs. When the father addresses his son in Proverbs, especially the first 10 chapters, there are two primary sources of temptation. There's the gang activity, the get-rich-quick scheme, and there's also sexual temptation, represented by that prostitute. Both of those temptations were enticing for the young man. This one in particular would have been a way for some to have, in injustice, pursued self-vindication, perhaps relying on their own strength, their own status. And the last one there is pretty simple. When the condition at the end of verse 10 suggests that if riches increase, do not set your heart upon them. Your own status can't get you there. Your greedy effort will not redeem you. Whatever it is that we may put our trust in pales in comparison to the rock, the salvation, the fortress, the refuge that David is clinging to. Isn't it amazing that the king of Israel recognized the need to bow his knee to the king of heaven? I've never been called a king. Far from it. But if the king of Israel, if God's own son in the flesh, knew that time well spent was time spent in prayer to the Father, relying on him as the rock and the refuge, the hope of our salvation, how much more should we cling to him? At the conclusion of the psalm, David calls our attention back to the fact that God isn't just sitting there. You know, he's a rock, but he doesn't respond to prayer like a rock. He hears what we say, and he's responsive to that prayer. And so David notes a couple of things in the last two verses of Psalm 62, that God has spoken and that God will bring forth justice, that God responded to our condition when sin demanded by his gracious initiative a response that would offer us salvation because we by our own merit couldn't get there. David's life proves that. My life proves that. God has spoken. I will listen. Power belongs to God. That's why I can't trust in the evildoer who's like a tottering fence. I can't trust in my own effort that's like a leaning wall. I trust in the security of God. That's where the power is. But notice that it's not just power. It's hard to think about a fortress being a comfortable place to be. It's hard to think about a stronghold being a place we feel right at home. But the last verse in Psalm 62 certainly invokes that imagery. Loving kindness is yours, O Lord. I know that you're not just my rock now. I know that you're not just present now and responsive now. I know that there's coming a day as I wait. I may be waiting for a day, a week, a month, a year. I may be waiting my whole life to see justice served as I desire, as you desire, Father, that all people everywhere be saved and come to a knowledge of the truth. I trust that you as judge are righteous. Reminds me of something that happens at the end of the book of Genesis. You remember that powerful moment when Joseph, looking back on the experiences that we've been reading about from Genesis 37 all the way through Genesis 50, being betrayed by his brothers, being forgotten as a slave sold into Egypt, how the recurring emphasis in Genesis 39 is that God was with him and through the pit and the palace and the prison and all the other things that happened with Potiphar's wife and the famine and Pharaoh after Jacob's dead, and the brothers are fearful that Joseph will take vengeance upon them, we see maturity in action. We see in hindsight Joseph able to express with clarity and peace that what these brothers had intended for evil, God meant for good. God meant it for good, not just for me, but for others. And think about it. Think about the people who are struggling so much with grief and with evil and with perhaps the sort of adversaries that David's speaking about, that those are precious souls made in the image of God. Perhaps if they've responded to grace and faith, who've been redeemed, who wear the name of Christ, and yet still they feel like they don't have any value. They feel like that if they went missing, nobody would notice. They feel forgotten. They feel alone. They feel abandoned. And they look at the situations that they're in and they wonder, how long, oh Lord, how long am I going to wait for a resolution here? How long am I going to have to wait until there are some answers? Why is this happening to me and my family? Why my career? Why is my life this way? And it's not to be trite. It's not a simple answer, but I wonder, like David, if there's simply a time to sit in trust, not knowing if today's the day, not knowing if the answer will come in this life, not knowing if that struggle that just consumes our time and our thoughts, if that will ever go away until glory, when we know that all injustice will be made right, when what is a tottering fence feels like a strong and mighty wall that will never come down. We trust that that wall is nothing compared to the rock and the stronghold and the refuge and the salvation we find in our Redeemer, our God. I wonder tonight if we could go to Psalm 62 and if some of us could pray this prayer. God, I trust you. I know that you're strong. I know that you're capable. I know that you will what's right. How long will I suffer in this way? How long will evildoers, whether it's Satan or his agents, seek my downfall? How long will I feel that there are people who are duplicitous in their actions and in their words? They say one thing and they think another. Help me to wait, Lord. I trust you. You're my refuge, my strength, my salvation. Help me to trust in you. Help me to pour out my heart before you, because I know that although you are my rock, you don't respond to prayer like a rock. Be my refuge. Help me not to trust in my own rank. Help me not to behave in ways that are contrary to your will. Help me, Father, not to trust in wealth, but instead to listen to your word. Help me, Lord, to trust in your power, to know that you're a just God and a powerful God, but a God of loving kindness. We know that you will bring about recompense for every person's work. Help us to trust. Help us to wait. Help us to understand that sometimes faith is expressed without burst of activity, but sometimes faith is demonstrated by a strong, gentle hand sitting by the bedside of someone who's struggling. Sometimes faith is demonstrated by the prayers of a spouse or a parent or a child who desperately want their family members to be right with the Lord. Sometimes strength is found in simply waiting, not knowing why we have this illness, not knowing why we find ourselves in a difficult situation, not knowing how God might use that in our lives. But God, the rock, the stronghold, our salvation, we trust him and we wait. You know, I talked about how hard it is to wait. Our God knows something about waiting. Our God's been waiting for some time, even though we know that with God, time is nothing. But in human ways of counting time, he's been waiting a long time for humanity to respond to his grace. I can't address the billions of people in the world, but I can look into my own heart and ask, why don't I trust God more? Why am I so impatient when things aren't exactly as I hoped that they would be? Why is it so difficult to wait on God when God has spent many days and years waiting on me? Is God waiting on us tonight? He's offered His will. He's offered His Son. He's communicated clearly, consistently, with perfect character, His love for us. We may have made the mistake of putting our faith in other people. We may have made the mistake of putting our faith in ourselves. And it doesn't take very long to play that game and to realize that that's not going to lead to happiness. And more importantly, that's not going to lead to eternal life. But as David spoke these words, he in selflessness recognized that he couldn't fix it. And perhaps it's time that some of us recognize we can't fix it either, but God can. God can redeem the broken. God can heal the brokenhearted. God can see us through some circumstances that are humanly incomprehensible because there's a peace that passes understanding. If you're struggling tonight, pray Psalm 62 and trust in the God who was present with David. If you're struggling tonight, know that you're not the only one praying Psalm 62. They're surrounded by shepherds who love you, by a congregation here that wants to support you, by people, if we were transparent, who may be struggling with the exact same situation, but who can recognize that God is big and strong and mighty. So here we are like tottering fences, trying to fix problems. And like David, perhaps we need to say, my soul, wait on God. He's strong and perfect. Tonight could be the night that He stops waiting, that we respond to His grace through faith, confessing that Jesus is Lord and being baptized for the forgiveness of sins. Or tonight may be the night that we have that conversation with someone in love because we want to be in heaven with them. We have that conversation with the Lord in love because we want to be in heaven with them. We make what's wrong right. We seek reconciliation as ambassadors of Christ because He desires that very work. I don't know the need, but I know our God, our rock. He invites us to respond to Him just like He was there with David. He's there tonight. He's here tonight. Let's come home to Him as we stand and sing.